Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Save big money on everything for your next bathroom project. Now at Menards. Upgrade your bathroom with Max. With more than 1,000 showers, bathtubs, and surrounds, you're sure to find exactly what you need to add luxury and style to your bathroom. Save big on our entire selection of Max bathroom products. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
That was the opening part of Moon River, and it was performed by Dominic Ferris. I'm Erica Wirth, and welcome to this Pianist podcast. In this hour-long discussion, Dominic Ferris and Ugna Peshtarecha talk about performance anxiety and how one deals with it.
Hello, I'm Dominic Ferris. I'm a pianist and a Steinway artist, and today I've returned to my alma mater, the Royal College of Music, to have a discussion on a topic that has been a passion of mine for many years, performance anxiety.
Hi, and I'm Ugna Peshtarecha. I'm a pianist. I did my master's and undergrad in solo piano, and I'm doing a PhD here at the Royal College of Music. And the topic of my interest is emotional intelligence and how it can help musicians perform better.
I'm so pleased that we've been able to come together today. This is a subject that we've been discussing organically at various times we've met over the last couple of years.
Yes.
And I'm intrigued to look at, the common ground between performance anxiety and emotional intelligence. And I think there are a lot of overlaps that we can discuss today.
Yes, there's indeed a lot of overlap, and I can comment a little bit on my studies as well as other people's research. And I'm very excited that we're finally documenting so many conversations we had about it.
I guess one of the big questions is, so many students that come to a conservatoire like the Royal College of Music, they spend so long attempting to perfect their skills in terms of performance, but there's so much outside of that psychologically that goes hand in hand with the end result. And I think the idea of process versus result is an interesting one to discuss, in the sense that students spend a long time physically rehearsing the music they're going to be performing in the concert or in the recital or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
But I think the internal psychology of what that student or that performer or that professional pianist, violinist, whatever, has to go through is, I think, a very interesting one that is so subjective to that individual performer.
Yeah, it's very interesting you say this, because this is exactly my motivation for doing research, from switching, you know, to being a full-time pianist to then starting to do research, because after playing for so many years, I started thinking, well, it's clearly not just thinking about the music, but it's also how we as humans come to perform. How do we, there are so many aspects, you know, your one instrument teacher might not necessarily have the same experience you have.
Yeah.
And all these aspects, not just about performance anxiety, but just in general. And this is what led me to emotional intelligence topic, which is highly under-researched in music domain.
So do you think it's a normal thing to get nervous, to get anxious before a performance? Do you think that's human nature?
I think there are, you know, as many people, as many opinions, but I can tell you what research says. So the prevalence varies hugely from study to study, from, yeah, you know, something like 24% of musicians experiencing music performance anxiety to 96%. Either way, it's the experience is significant to, you know, to a certain extent, where some musicians even cease their careers because of that.
Yeah.
And there's been a huge shift. This domain is one of the most researched,
yeah,
and in the music performance world. But it's very interesting because the prevalence over these decades of research hasn't changed. And at the start of research, this was a bit of a taboo to talk about. Then people started talking about experience of music performance anxiety a lot. And currently there is this recent shift of not fighting, not trying to cure music performance anxiety, but rather accepting and sort of embracing and learning how to cope with that.
I think as a piano player, one of the things that I always used to get a little anxious about is turning up at a concert hall and not knowing what piano you're going to play, or not having rehearsed or performed in that space, yeah, before. Because I think a lot of other instrumentalists, if you're a violinist or a flautist or whatever, you'd get to bring your own instrument to the performance venue.
Yeah.
And I think the idea of turning up to a piano, however good that piano may be,
yeah,
it's still an unknown in terms of sitting down.
Yeah.
You're in an acoustic that maybe you don't
exactly
know.
Exactly. There are so many variables. Yes.
And I think that can be a sort of a bit of a daunting factor.
Really, yeah, absolutely.
Before
absolutely
you sit down and play. I always use the idea, I called it the mirror technique. I don't know if this is something that is common in research or something that other musicians share.
When
you walk out on a stage, mm-hmm, as a performer, if you're doing, say, a solo piano recital, let's mm-hmm say, the first thing you see is this sea of people
mm-hmm
looking back at you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a performer, that can be quite daunting. But if you turn that around, imagine you were an audience member sitting mm-hmm in the audience looking at the performer.
Mm-hmm.
An audience member wouldn't be concerned about all of the other people in the room. They would be concerned purely for the artist. So yeah, as an artist now, when I look out into an audience, I try and have a one-on-one personal relationship
mm-hmm
with everyone in the room,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to this sea of people, you know. And I think now, I mean, we're here in the Royal College of Music and we're here in this, yeah, performance laboratory.
Yeah, for those seeing us on a video format.
Yeah, exactly.
We have all kinds of halls behind us changing. And this is exactly what you're talking about. You know, you can come to Simulator, which I think for now is one of a kind, just at the Royal College of Music. Later on, maybe somebody will replicate it, which is, I think, somebody would wish to happen, because it's such an amazing tool to have that, you know, to fill in the gap between practicing in a small practice room to then having to go on a stage like that and see all these people sitting in the audience and then having to deal with that in that moment. Because you also, when you rehearse, the hall is empty,
yeah,
acoustic is different.
Yeah.
Even if you're coming with your own instrument, oh,
yeah,
they're
they
applauding.
Are clapping.
Yeah, they're
so
clapping.
You can, so with this technique, I mean, I didn't have any of this when I was here.
Yeah, it's quite recent.
This is completely recent. And this is amazing. So an instrumentalist can come in here,
yeah,
and they can choose whatever venue they're performing in, be it the, yeah, concert hall, the Britain Theatre.
Yeah, for now, I think there are like something like five. There's the main concert hall, there's the Britain Theatre. And I think in future, the plan is to, I think they might already be preparing the Royal Albert Hall.
Uh-huh.
And we're in the small simulator. So small simulator has one option for acoustic, but in the big simulator, which you saw before,
yes, yeah,
you can choose different acoustic as well. So what they did, they took this incredible machine to the actual halls,
yeah,
and
yeah,
that machine sends signals and copies the acoustic of that room, and then they bring it back to the simulator to the performance simulator, and they install that acoustic there. So you can buy a, you know, press of a button, you can change acoustic, and you can practice in that acoustic, not just visually, but also acoustically.
But I think it's interesting that you can, in the software, you can select certain reactions from the audience.
Oh, yeah, that's also
so,
yeah.
You know, they can be clapping, they can be, did we enjoy that?
Yeah, you can change their reaction, first of all. Like, they can be indifferent, they can be unsatisfied.
So this
oh,
chap
that's,
here...
I think that's unsatisfied.
This clap. Chap here in the front row doesn't look very impressed. Oh, he's clapping now.
Yeah,
he's
they're all, now. I think, clapping unsatisfied
yeah.
now.
But do you know what's really interesting? Yeah. Like, I do concerts in various countries around the world, and the idea of being impressed in one country is a very different idea. So let's take the Philippines, for example. Mm. Performing in the Philippines, if you do a performance that you think, oh, it's okay, you know, the appreciation is incredible. Mm-hmm. It really is very warm. There is a bit of... The other thing that's interesting overseas is... what they deem to be normal in terms of their local culture. Mm-hmm. So they'll applaud a song and be really, really into it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they'll be having a chat with the person next to them. Oh, that's, you know, did you enjoy that? And it's audible from the stage.
Oh, my.
So that's another very interesting thing, because I think here in the UK, we're used to this concert-going culture. If you're going to go and see Mahler Symphony at the Royal Festival Hall, the idea of it being absolutely silent. And if you made the slightest noise, I mean, if someone, I mean, woe betide you, if someone's phone went off, everyone looks, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, and looks, who was that ruining the symphony? Whereas that, if that happened in some of the Southeast Asian countries, it's like, oh yeah, yes, it's fine. You know, and we carry on. And it's all part of the live embracing of the event.
Yeah.
And then there are other countries where you can perform, and they enjoyed it, but it's not rapturous applause. It's quite a subdued response.
Yeah.
So that poses the question, well, you know, where is the center of that? How can you read into that objectively in terms of the relationship from the audience and the appreciation of the performance? And also, how would the performer be expected to respond to these different external influences?
Yeah, well... what do you think? I would imagine this, you know, the performer has to just consider these aspects and keep that in mind. I know that, for example, if you go somewhere in China, you're greeted like a rock star. Everyone is, there's always a stand-up applause, no matter, you know, it's not just for you to come from West. It isn't from the West. It's none of that, anything else matters.
I think it does take emotional strength sometimes. I mean, I've been on stages where I've been playing... you know, a fairly in-depth classical piece where, you know, you're in the middle of say, the development section, and then there'd be a little distraction that sometimes turns into a big distraction. Then out the corner of your eye, out of your peripheral vision, you can see someone sort of get up and, you know, faff around and move down the end. But I think that's a great opportunity to focus.
Yeah.
On the present moment. Mm. And I think focusing on the present moment, to me, is the central way. It's a way of complete flow, where you can remove the conscious almost. You can remove any internal voices that are doubting the unobstructed journey to the end goal.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a fascinating thing, but that's very personal to me.
Mm.
And I guess that's how I've managed to move from a time when I used to get anxious about performances or whatever to a point where someone says, you know, 3 minutes before the show, okay, we're live to an audience of millions and we've got this happening and that happening. And you just, you somehow go into this place where none of that matters. It's all outside of your bubble. Because the only thing that matters is your job. And you go on and you're in this protected bubble, rather like a rehearsal room situation.
Okay.
And I'd be very interested from your research to know how the level of emotional intelligence can affect anxiety or certainly the relationship between those two things. Because I'm sure there must be a connection.
Yes. So, yeah, emotional intelligence is related to... quite a few aspects. So I think, first of all, what you were talking about is this experience of flow and entering the zone of performance, which is what we define in, so to speak, academic literature and research. And it's interesting you call it, you know, almost subconscious, because it's defined as highly, highly conscious focus, but on one thing, just doing one action. So it's like you're almost in a tunnel vision and you're just focusing on doing this one thing. And I, you know, I heard musicians say stories how fire alarm went on and they didn't hear because they were so in the zone. They were so in the flow. And I'm sure you can relate to that as well. So emotional intelligence is, in fact, related to the experience of flow, which is also a key component to, you know, highly, highly skilled performance. But if we're talking about music performance anxiety, my recent study found that emotional intelligence actually predicts music performance anxiety by 45%. And what that means is it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, if you're experiencing anxiety, you're not emotionally intelligent. Absolutely not. So it doesn't, being emotionally intelligent doesn't mean that you're not going to experience anxiety, but that you know how to cope with that better and you know how to regulate, how to get into that zone of optimal performance. Because everyone's state or sort of state of arousal or anxiety or excitement, whatever you want to call it, is different. So you need to be emotionally intelligent to know how to enter it into that optimal state of arousal for performing at your best.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing concerts where you're in the wings with another performer, say, 2 minutes before the performance starts, and they are completely in a delirious state. You know, they don't know how they're going to cope with this impending doom of walking out on that stage. But yet, 2 minutes into the performance, completely relaxed. So I think the fear of what's to come, I think when they're inside that bubble and when they're doing what they love and they're with their instrument and they feel at ease, you know, I think that can be a state of calm. But I think it's the thoughts of approaching that from the outside, because when you're stood in the wings, you know, you it's that whole idea of I need to impress the audience. And I think that's another topic, because when I approach a performance, the motive is always important. The only person I want to impress is myself. You know, people have paid for a ticket and they want to come along. That's very nice. Lovely of you to come. See you at the end. But the only person that matters to me is, did I do a good job? And am I happy with it? I don't really get swayed or influenced by opinions, positive or negative. And I don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing. I guess that's an installation of trust over the years, an installation of experience over the years, and to know where your boundaries are. Because I remember back to the old days, and I used to be going on stage and performing various pieces or songs or whatever it may be. And everything changes. Your perception of how you played something is absolutely not what you played. And I think the only way to get rid of that, to eliminate that, is to create this idea of flow, so there is complete balance and understanding between what you think you're doing and what you're actually doing. So the balance between process and result. Tempo, for example, was something that I remember being all over the place. Because when you're slightly nervous or slightly anxious, you tend to, everything seems faster to the listener, but it feels completely normal to you. And I remember playing, I think it was Rhapsody in Blue, the end, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I was playing it and I was on stage thinking, this has got to be quicker, Dom. You know, it's not fast enough. And I watched the recording at the end. I thought, I didn't even know I could play that quickly. So it's that idea of what you're doing is actually not what the result is. And I think that goes back to what you were saying about being aware. I think more performers should use their past performances as research to improve. I feel that certainly when I was training, a lot of the emphasis was put on the relationship between your professor and the student and the preparation phase for the concert. But I think the concert itself is just as much as a learning tool.
Exactly,
to be able to move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree. And I think there's a lot of work being done on, you know, practicing not just the pieces you're going to perform, but also practicing performance. And again, this brings us back to this idea of why the simulator was created, because when you look at other domains of performance, for example, you know, piloting or like doing surgery, you know, doing something in time. And this is where the idea came from. My supervisors, Aaron William and George Waddell, they, you know, they looked at other areas of performance where they have simulators. Pilots don't just go straight away and, you know, pilot a plane. They go into simulators, and the same with the surgeons. They first go into operating theaters and they practice performance. And this is how this whole idea of a simulator was born. So practicing performance is a very, very important thing to do, which I think a lot of musicians maybe don't think about. And, well, hopefully they do.
So the question would be, to make it a real experience, like you talk about pilots and surgeons, and the question would be, would a pilot, just as he's taxiing out onto the runway, would that pilot be anxious before takeoff? Would there be any hint of, okay, I'm going to push the thrust levers forward, and then we're going to rotate and we're going to take off? Do they know for sure that's going to be the case, in the same way that as a performer walks on stage, we can be sure, we can't be sure that someone's not going to cough in the front row and put us off. The only difference is we don't have that level of responsibility as performers.
But, you know, I think being anxious doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to impair your performance quality. And this is something that's been proved a lot and demonstrated a lot in research. And I mean, we cannot really know for sure if a pilot is anxious or not anxious, but we do know that practicing and doing that consistently helps. And as I understand, you don't feel like you get performance anxiety now these days, which is not necessarily something that what I learn when I do research. Some musicians say that, you know, it reduces with experience. For for others, it actually increases with the responsibility of job. So it's not, and it's not consistent in research to say that with experience, music performance anxiety actually reduces. Some might have a very unsuccessful performance, and this will then, you know, trigger every time they go on stage. They just recall that situation, and they get really debilitating anxiety. But most importantly is to know that anxiety doesn't necessarily impair your performance. And a lot of the time, it's actually a little bit of it is needed to make it special.
To make it,
So it's just entering that zone that is helpful for you to make it special. That's what's really important.
Well, I mean, I remember being 8 years. I didn't have a choice when I was a child. You know, my mother thrust me out on the stage, and she was a singer. And she, you know, used to be there, and I used to be playing the piano at the back. And she'd shout out the chords, you know, she was C, A minor, F, and she'd be singing something. And, you know, I was 8 years old, and I had an audience, and I didn't really understand. I couldn't, at that age, you can't process what's happening. But I think maybe having that innate grounding from an early age, and then later the classical training sort of started in a more formal way. But I think comparing those examples that you just referenced about surgeons and about pilots, they have an absence of emotion, arguably, because it's a logical performance that they're doing. You know, you get into a plane, you look at the, I'm a bit of an aviation geek, so that's why. you look at the QRH, which is your checklist, and you go through that point by point, and you do that in the order every time you take off, bearing in mind, obviously, the external conditions, which would be, you know, the atmospheric conditions. But I think when you perform, you can't have a logical approach. It has to be an emotional understanding of what you're about to do. And I think that's where the problem comes.
You touched on a really, really interesting topic, which is another part of my research. And this is definitely something, you know, this is one of the main differences that becomes when you have discussions with these pilots and with surgeons, because what we also do with simulators, we do a knowledge exchange program where, you know, you get surgeons to come in, perform in this simulator, and musicians go to perform in their operating theater. And then you get this experience where I think musicians a lot of the time come out and they're like, actually, you know what, performing on stage is not that scary.
Yeah.
And surgeons actually come out of this and say like, oh my God, like just doing what you're doing in front of all these people is, you know, it's so scary. It's so,
yeah.
So it's very interesting to have this different perspective of different theater. But one of the main observations is that, you know, surgeons say, well, we don't really care how emotionally expressively we see someone's body. You know?
I think control has a lot to do with it as well, because tell me if I'm wrong here, but certainly when I used to get a little, you know, anxious about performances, I remember being accountable to the audience liking what I was going to do.
Mm.
I cared a lot about what people thought.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if this is complacent of me to say, but I think taking back control and feeling like you're in control is a...
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Performer. It takes that accountability away, because you're just going to do, the way I approach it now is I'm going to go and do what I'm going to do.
Mm.
And if the audience like it, that's lovely. Mm-hmm. If they don't like it, that's also fine. I think human nature in terms of feedback is always to focus on the negative, right?
Mm.
So if you get a review, you've got, you know, 100 people, 98 people loved it, 2 people didn't like it.
Yeah.
Where does the mind go? It goes to those people that maybe had a problem with it or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think that's okay. I think you've got to get to that level of acceptance.
Mm.
You can't please everyone. They're always going to compare your performance to, you know, this recording that they absolutely adored when they were 16 years old, because I think that's another interesting point of discussion is that, slightly off topic, but, you know, we always go to that first version that we heard of something or that first recording that we heard of something. And that becomes a special thing. And you could listen to any covers of that or any, you know, live recordings or whatever, and it never has that special magic. So, and what you might think is a great performance, 90% of the audience might think, you know, what on earth were you doing?
You touch on a very key aspect, you know, in music, in the experience of music performance anxiety, because, and I remember you talking about this a little bit more on the seminar you did for the Pianist magazine.
Yes.
On music performance anxiety, and it struck me when you said that you perceive anxiety or arousal going on stage as something that you control, or like performing on stage as something that you control, because not everybody sees it that way. And then I looked into some literature, and I saw that this is actually one of the key aspects, and it changes massively how you then able to execute your performance and how you're able to achieve your goals and how you're able to actually control that just that perception of I'm going on stage and I can control what is going to happen on stage, or I'm going on stage and I have no idea, maybe my fingers are going to be trembling so much that, you know, this is, but also it's the focus, because you can go on stage and focus on what are they going to think, or like if it's an exam, how much, what's my mark going to be?
Yeah.
Or you can focus on your own standards and I want this to be my personal best performance, or I want this, you know, just to make myself happy with what I did, which can actually be much harder than pleasing the audience.
Yeah, I think there are practical things. I think, you know, maybe this is a good time to talk about, you know, some practical ideas. I know a lot of performers, or have known a lot of performers, where from the moment, if they've got a show in that night, if they've got a concert that night,
mm-hmm.
from the moment they wake up that morning,
mm-hmm.
they're a completely different person.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to be that person.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you what, it was exhausting. I mean, by the time you get to 6 o'clock at night, your mind's been working overtime all day. And you're thinking, oh my gosh, you know, what happens if there's traffic? What if I get to the venue late? Is the piano going to be okay? What happens if they haven't got the, you know, water in the dressing room? What happens if the venue's too warm? You know, all of these hypothetical inner voices that are so destructive psychologically. And I'm going to reference this book here called The Inner Game of Music. It was originally a book... it started out as The Inner Game of Tennis because it talks about parallels between the psychology of a tennis player and the psychology of a performing musician.
Well, this is exactly what we're studying.
And the whole idea of this is the idea of having two voices in your head, self one being the destructive voice, the inner voice, the external disruption from the audience, and self two, which is your ultimate potential. And the idea of rather than trying to improve self two, by practicing and making sure this passage is technically perfect. Instead, we take away the idea of self-one. We learn to lessen self-one, these distractions. And the way that I started to do that was by making a show day into the most ordinary day and not even thinking about the performance until we get to 5, 6 o'clock in the evening. Now, that takes a huge psychological shift in order to achieve that. But it's done in baby steps because I think going to the venue, that's the other thing. You know, I've known pianists that turn up in a venue and maybe they're not sure of the piano. And they play huge chunks of the concert through in rehearsal. And to me, I mean, this is just my opinion, but I don't believe you can actually improve your level of playing on the day of the performance. I mean, all that needs to be done way in advance. So to me, that's a waste of precious calories. It's a waste of precious energy that you're going to need for that performance. So, you know, I don't want to give advice, but, you know, an idea maybe would be to come to that rehearsal with the sole goal of making sure the piano fits with you, you know, or bringing your violin on stage, making sure that you're happy with the acoustic and knowing that that acoustic's going to change as soon as the audience is full of people, as soon as those seats are filled with people. And I think it's those things that can be productive. But the idea of coming on stage and already being on the back foot by thinking, oh my gosh, it's show day. Is everything done? Is maybe the suit's got creases in? You know, what will people think? Should I wear this? Should I? It's all of that external traffic in your mind. And it's learning to silence that. And I believe, this is my belief, that if a performer can silence those thoughts, you know, the music can still happen. You know, that's what's going to happen. If you're spending the day thinking about the piece in your mind and rehearsing in your mind, and go, that's fine because that's calm and it's you're in the present moment and you're focusing on a soul idea. But this whole idea of moving from here to here and, oh my gosh, the traffic and this, that's not going to work. You know, that needs to go. And I think the reality is, of course, we've got to get to the venue and it might be a hot day. And we get, but there are ways of managing that psychologically. You know.
Oh gosh, you touched on so many.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's amazing. It's amazing. I guess I would first start to say that we have applause.
They like it.
They like it. They like what you said. Probably most important thing is to say that to each their own, probably, when it comes to like routines and whatnot. But I hear a lot of the people saying this where, you know, you have to have a... not necessarily that you don't have to do anything on the day, but you have to take things as they come. You know, like not being like, oh my gosh, I have a performance today, but rather everything is fine. Everything's okay. You know, be prepared for anything. Be open, in other words, whatever comes your way. And then, yes, because, you know, the prevalence over decades of research in music performance anxiety, it hasn't really changed, which shows that all the interventions that were carried out are not really effective, which then leads to think that, first of all, it's more likely that everyone has to find their own way to cope and manage anxiety. And second of all, is that probably fighting it or seeing it as a problem doesn't necessarily, it's a little bit counterproductive because you spend so much energy on thinking how you're feeling or like trying to calm yourself down, and instead accepting, you know, accepting that you're going to be in a hall where the acoustic is going to change anyway, depending on how many people there's going to be. Then if you're a pianist, you know, you have to get used to the instrument, but you won't get used to the instrument in you know, what hour, 1 hour or so you have to rehearse. And exactly, so then running it all through, instead of trying to control, just accepting, you know, what comes your way, I think is kind of, I can second it from my point of view to what you said, and you know, agree with you that... Yeah. Is something that,
and in terms of the music itself, do you think that, I mean, I've been in situations here at the Royal College of Music. I remember being here, and my professor Nigel Clayton at the time, he said, "Dominic, I think you should play the Brahms Opus 117. What do you think of that?" And it was always a conversation. You know, he would never tell me to play something. It would all be, "But what do you think of this?" And I remember learning it, and you know, I worked on the piece with him, but I remember part of it being technically very challenging, and it's that idea of would you consciously take a piece of music that's right on the edge of your technical ability into a situation like this, where you've got all of these people watching you, and it probably won't, but it might go wrong. There might be a slip up.
Yeah.
Or would you argue that that is, you're able to learn from that, as opposed to taking a piece that's technically more straightforward, that you know is going to be fine, and it's safer?
You raise a really, really good question. So basically, when it comes to the experience of stress or anxiety or arousal, there are three key aspects, because we can find so many sources and so many causes of why you get anxious, you know, be it the sweaty hands, slippery keys, but basically three sources. Personality, so how as a person you're likely to get anxious.
Okay.
Then task difficulty, which is what you're talking in this case. How difficult is the piece? And then the third one is the importance of the event. So how important is this event?
Okay, that's interesting.
And so by knowing yourself as a person, so say I know that I'm likely to get anxious, you know, I'm more anxious than others, for example, or just, I just know that I will get anxious for every performance. And my teacher really wants me to play this really complicated piece, or I really want to play it, you know, it's my dream come true, but it's really complicated and I'm not sure how well it's going to go. Then I'll alter the third aspect, which is, situation importance. So for instance, and even if I have to, you know, perform it at a really important concert, you can still then do things in steps before that. So for example, you can have run-throughs with your family, with your friends, you can do smaller concerts. You can, you know, slowly raise the level of that very complicated piece to the point where you feel like at home when you're playing it. What you can also do, you know, if it's, for example, an exam and it's a bit dreadful to play to, you know, a panel of critics or experts or whatever you call them, you can invite your own audience. You can invite people who help you feel better and so on. So just like that, playing with these three aspects.
I mean, the emphasis that you put on the third point of the importance of the performance, that's an interesting one for me. What I try to do when I approach a performance, I try to have exactly the same mindset from if I'm just playing at my local village hall to if I'm doing a live national broadcast. To me, I try to get myself to the point. That was my goal, to overcome performance anxiety, to get my point.
And you reached it.
And I hope I reached it. I mean, you have good days and bad days.
It wouldn't work for me.
You have good
if I had to perform at the Royal Albert Hall, I would be like, I can tell myself as much as I want to.
Don't you feel you get to a point where, I mean, I guess that's slightly different because you've moved into research, whereas my primary, you know, sort of sphere is still performance. I think experience has a lot to do with it. And I think, you don't learn from success. You can't learn anything from success, in my belief. You can remember it as a nice event, but you can't learn anything from it. You can only learn from something that goes wrong, because then you take that as a mechanism to improve and become better, so that you're then stronger and you become more fail-safe. And I believe that to be across, I mean, that's across the whole, you know, all creative genres, I would say, not just music. Mm. You know, an actor that watches themselves on screen, you know, 20 years ago and might cringe at their performance at a role, it's the same for musicians. You know, you think, well, why did you do it like that? Mm. But surely you have to go through that process in order to refine your level of performance and therefore skill.
Yeah, but see, but this is where I think you're a good example of someone who's very much aware and who's not in denial or suppression of, you know, what's happening and what's going on with you. Because there are musicians, and I know examples where, you know, they would deny or suppress or fight certain feelings. And when you are aware and when you are approaching it from the place of openness, that's when you can learn, can find, you know, and this with this positive mindset where you are willing to grow and willing to learn from the experience rather than say, you know, oh, this was awful.
Yeah.
And God, I hope I will never experience that again.
Well, I remember here when I was a student here at the Royal College of Music, and I remember coming in my first year, and I always had a passion for American music, you know, Gershwin, and I was never one to gravitate towards the Bach Chromatic Fantasy and Fugue or something, you know. And I remember coming in, and I used to see all these amazing, technically proficient contemporaries and peers in my year, and I used to get very anxious in those situations where, you know, Vanessa Latarche, the head of keyboard here, would get us together in the parry room, and it used to be an opportunity to play whatever material that you're working on to the rest of your year.
Yeah.
And in a way, at the time, as a 19-year-old or whatever I was at the time, that's a terrifying ordeal to go through, because you think, well, here we are, we're not just in a room of audience, we're in a room full of first study pianists who are doing exactly the same thing as you. And I don't think, maybe this relates back to emotional intelligence, I don't think when you're 19 years old, sometimes you can't compute the fact that actually they want to support you, they're on your side. And I think that's the case for an audience. You know, if I'm a ticket buyer and I go and see somebody that I want to go and see perform, I want to sit in the audience and watch them succeed, and I'm cheering them on.
Yeah.
And I feel that there's a complete inverse relationship there, because there's the anxious performer sat on stage saying, oh my gosh, everything can go wrong. And there's 98 of the percent of the audience, or 99, hopefully 100% of the audience saying, come on, you got this. Mm. This is going to be great.
Yeah.
So to me, where's that dividing line? Why is this fourth wall creating a mirror image?
I remember going and realizing this as well, and it took me a while as well. At the academy where I studied, we also used to have these kind of sessions, which is actually a good idea, because essentially you're practicing to perform, and you're probably performing to a more critical audience than you would normally do. But I think when I realized, I was really surprised that no one, you know, no one told me that, well, actually, everyone wants you to succeed.
Yeah.
No one wants, you know, no one wants to criticize you.
Yeah.
And these are some of the aspects, again, that, you know, training of emotional intelligence and training that is already being done. For example, here at the Royal College of Music, a lot of, you know, psychological skills, performance psychology, and all these things. Musicians are receiving all this training, which is something that, you know, I hope I received when I studied piano.
I mean, I've got to say, this is great. I would have relished in coming in, particularly because I know there's another performance simulator here at the college,
and
the bigger one, yeah. And I was absolutely blown away when you showed me that, because I thought, wow, this is so realistic. To the way that it sounds, to the way that it looks. And it's obviously, I mean, we've got screens all around us here, but the other simulator is a properly immersive environment where it really does feel like you're on stage playing.
Yes.
And I thought the other setting, I mean, obviously we're here with an audience, but the setting of the panel.
The panel, yes.
When you're being examined, because that's a whole nother topic of conversation that I know we haven't got time to discuss today, but the idea of being judged, essentially, by a panel, that's very different for me. I would probably still be terrified of that. So if you ask me to play in front of an audience, that's fine. If you said, right, Vanessa's going to come with two people and they're going to judge you on how you've developed since graduating from the Royal College of Music, I'd absolutely go to pieces. Having said that, there is one person that I know His name is Michael Main. He's my childhood mentor. Mm-hmm. And he was the one that really inspired me with my music when I was young. Mm-hmm. And whenever he comes to my shows now, even now, you know, all these years later, he sits in the audience. Mm-hmm. And he is the only person where I think, oh, gosh, let's get it right, Dom. Let's get it right.
Interesting.
You know, oh, my gosh, he's here. But it's like, okay, let's get this right for him. I don't want to let my teacher down. Mm-hmm. He still has that hold over me, mm-hmm. even now. And I think that's maybe that would be the case with, I think it would be the case with Nigel. Mm-hmm. You know, Nigel, he actually came to one of my concerts at Cadogan Hall, mm-hmm. About 3 or 4 years ago, and he sat right in the front row. I was like, Nigel, why are you sat there?
And he thought he was sending you good energy.
Of course, that was his response. Absolutely. But I think that there's one other point that I wrote down, which I'd be really interested to hear your response to, because you talked about, you know, a performer going into being very present and in the moment, but being super focused on one particular discipline, you know, be it the performance or whatever. For me, as the years have gone by, it's become, there's definitely a detach with the conscious. There's definitely an idea of being in control, but trusting your subconscious enough to know that nothing's going to go wrong. Whether that's a complacent way to think, I don't know. It works for me. Usually it's fine. Occasionally it's not, mm-hmm. but the majority is it's fine. So mm-hmm. that's my approach. But sometimes there are moments, and I can count these moments, maybe it happens once every 10 performances. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's influenced by the audience or the external factors, but there's just something. I can be playing a piece of music or one of my own piano arrangements, mm. and there's a depth that I go to. Mm. It's almost like a, not a spiritual connection, but a very deep musical connection where I'm just totally inside the idea of the music, and there's all colors everywhere, and it's almost like a half dream state. And to me, that's always my aim. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always happen because you can't force to get there. It's mm-hmm. got to happen. And it's like you can't force yourself to go to sleep, right? It just happens. Mm-hmm. And it's that idea of wanting to reach that place. Mm-hmm. And if I do reach that place, I thought, oh, that's nice. And I don't feel tired. It's like a place that I go to, and then you come out the other side and you think, oh, that was nice. And then you go home and then you switch it off. Whereas there's other performances that, you know, even now I think, come on, what's going on? Come on, you can play better than this, Dom, what's happening? Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's always that. I can count the number of performances that I've been totally impressed with on two hands mm-hmm. in 30 years of playing. Mm-hmm. And I hope that's the right approach, you know, to always want to be better and to always want to understand the music better.
Yeah. You know? So, like I mentioned before, I think it is the good approach, your internal motivation and your internal goals, as opposed to trying to impress someone. But jokingly, I also said it might be harder to impress yourself than impress the audience, right? Depending on your standards.
Yeah.
But that is definitely the case. And what you're defining is absolutely the experience of flow. So, you know, it can feel like subconscious or unconscious almost for you, but in research it is defined as actually highly focused, but probably so focused that it's, you know, it's just flowing, and it's highly sort of conscious state of just doing what you're just being so immersed in it that nothing else matters.
But this is the antithesis of reading music. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when I was young, I learned to play by ear. From the age of 5, when I started to play the piano, I spent 6 years training my ear. I didn't even look at a piece of sheet music. Mm. And I believe, looking back, that was a positive thing. Mm-hmm. Because you learn to listen. When you go to learn a new language, mm-hmm. the first thing somebody says is, right, well, go to the country. Mm-hmm. And what are you doing? You're listening to people speaking in that in that language. Mm-hmm. And I think that the technicality of reading and writing and reading the music, mm-hmm. you know, I believe that that's something that can be applied by anyone that wants to do that. But I think the idea of listening is an integral part of the growth, certainly of a young student, because I've come across pianists and musicians that haven't been allowed that time you know, when they were 6 years old, there was a teacher there saying, right, this is middle C, this is D, this is where it is on the piano.
Yeah.
And to me, this is my personal opinion, but to me, training that way is limiting because it allows for a two-dimensional relationship with the music as opposed to that idea of relying on your ear. And the music is then becomes the catalyst to you giving that performance, rather like an actor wouldn't, well, you know, he would learn from the script or whatever, the script would then go down and then they'd make it their own performance, which is why I'm always a great champion of a performer playing from memory, because I feel that the music can be a, it can be the physical sheet music here, you know, in front of you, to
it's
me
a
that
barrier.
It's a barrier.
Yeah, I think lots of people feel the same. And my supervisor also did research on the other side where they asked audience if they felt performance was different when playing from a music sheet. And so actually it was a cellist playing to an audience with a stand, but there was no sheet in front of, no music sheet.
Oh.
So all the time they played by heart. But, and guess what? The audience didn't like as much the performance with the stand.
So it's the physical obstruction of the stand.
Yeah, well, I think, and they're just, you know, projection that, oh, well, you don't know the piece that well, or or just it probably feels more natural, or like there is no boundary in front of you.
Well, I think there's a protocol that goes with classical performance, which I've never personally been a fan of. The idea of a pianist walking out on stage, you know, there might be polite applause, and you come and you take your bow at the piano and you sit down and you might take a few seconds to adjust the stool and sort yourself out before you start to play. To me, if anything, that I mean, if I did, if I came on stage and did that, that would, that's my idea of a nightmare. You know, it's being terrified by the prospect of coming on and it's all very formal. I think there should be, my belief is there should be more emphasis with young performers being able to break that fourth wall between us and the audience and being able to come out on stage saying, well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's wonderful to be here today. Now, today I've prepared a varied program for you when we're going to be starting with some J.S. Bach. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about the music as we move through the afternoon. You know, to me, that's a much more personable approach.
Absolutely.
And I do believe that all performers are capable of that. Some might find it more, they might find it more comfortable than others. But I do believe that from an audience perspective, I don't know if this goes in line with what your professor was saying, but we as an audience like to feel relaxed. And I think that that idea of breaking that protocol of formality is a good idea, you know, to do that. And I would again, I don't want to give advice, but but maybe that's something that, that performers could try, even if they just sit at the piano and say, hello, now I'm going to start my first piece, which is this.
You know? I think quite a few musicians are already doing it, at least introducing their pieces, sometimes saying something. I am personally one of these musicians who just let me play. Oh God, no! I don't want to. I don't want to, because this is a different type of performance. Talking to audience is one performance. Playing to an audience is a different performance. But also because I wasn't trained for it. Like I was trained in this very conservative manner of you just come, you bow, you perform. And I envy those who can do it. And I, you know.
But do you feel like you couldn't, or do you feel like you prefer not to?
No, I probably could. Like it would take some time to practice, and I would be able to. But I think a lot of musicians do that, but it's more in smaller halls.
Right.
So, and when we go to, you know, big hall classical concerts, usually musicians don't necessarily talk, but also it's because I think it's really difficult for them to speak up so that everybody hears them.
And then the conductor turns around and talks and you think, right, here we go, 15 minutes of talking.
But I think it's another form of art, you know, also knowing how much to say, and or it's just you're building your own image and personality where this is what we know what to expect from you. And we know what kind of, how you're going to warm up the evening, how are you going to introduce us into music and stuff like that.
So just you know, wrapping up our conversation, do you think that do you think that, having done the level of research that you have in this area, do you think there should be more emphasis placed on lessening the levels of anxiety on young performers breaking out into the industry? And if so, do you think that that would have a positive effect straight away on their level of performance and their approach to what they're doing?
I think throughout all the decades that this research in the domain exists, everybody wanted to lessen and lower the levels of music performance anxiety. Had they been successful? No. So I think we're still, well, to some extent.
Well, until now we've got this.
Yeah, we've got this.
I mean, this is a big breakthrough, right?
I think the more tools we have, the better, because, you know, everybody can choose what's better for them. But yeah. Yes, so recent shift is, you know, something like mindfulness or acceptance therapies, where people are just aware and they accept and they just train themselves to be with that feeling, to sit with that feeling.
Yeah.
We don't know much about how emotional intelligence could impact that, because there is very little research done. So we know that it is very related and the relationship is big, but we've not done, scientifically speaking, an empirical intervention where we could actually see, you know, like a pill, you give a pill, so you give, you know, emotional intelligence training, and then you see if anxiety reduces. But in other domains, it's been highly successful. So there is a likelihood it will work, and hopefully this job is going to be done soon. And also, given that, in fact, musicians score quite low on emotional intelligence.
Interesting.
This, again, gives hopes that with emotional intelligence training, this could, you know, could cause a rather big result in anxiety experiences.
I mean, if I could give one tip to any performers, oh, they liked your response then. I've got to say, this is absolutely fantastic. How I wish that we had something like this.
Can we get some
here
standing ovations?
When I was here. Oh, are there standing ovations?
There might be.
But doing this as much as possible, I think, is the best way. If I could give one tip to a young performer.
Oh,
there we go. Thank you very much.
Amazing. Thank you.
If I could give one tip to a young performer, it would be to perform, to put yourself in front of people, no matter if it's your mum, your dad, your brother, your friend, an audience playing at the church hall or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
Repetition, I think, has a big part to play. And that's certainly what's helped me in my career. But this is wonderful. Thank you so much for talking today. It's been a real insight into your research.
It's been such a pleasure.
And it makes me want to come back more and go back 20 years so that I can bring the technology back to when I was there. But thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Dominic.
Thank you.
That was the gorgeous melody of Moon River, and it was performed by Dominic Ferris. Pianist podcasts are free, and a really good way to support what we do is by subscribing to Pianist. Visit our website at pianistmagazine.com and listen to us on YouTube by searching Pianist Magazine. And don't forget to sign up to our newsletter, which is full of extra playing tips and useful information. Go to pianistmagazine.com to find out how to sign up.